as a family, we arrived in Australia in July 1948, just ahead of the government-sponsored migrant program from the UK. And my parents had been always very, very active people, and they thought that they would like to be part of the Scottish community here. So they explored the Scottish community, attended the Caledonian Society in town and at Port Adelaide, and went up to Mount Barker, and found that it didn't satisfy their need. When we went to the Port Adelaide branch, they had a bands class from 7 until 8 when you had to do Highland dancing, and then they had ballroom dancing. They perhaps had the odd Eightsome Reel or Strip the Willow, but that was all. The port, of course, was close to the migrant camp at... what was the suburb, Dunnoo? There was a big migrant camp down... Rosewater? No, it wasn't Rosewater. It was down, anyway, fairly near the Port Adelaide. And I think that they too came to the Caledonian Society looking for this extension of Scotland, if I can put it that way. There were many reasons why those people were coming, some for employment to the weapons research at Salisbury, some because jobs were scarce in the UK, and so when they heard that my mother was a qualified Scottish country dancing teacher, one of only two in Australia and the other one was in Sydney, a movement began to cluster around my parents to set up a branch of the RSCDS here in Adelaide. It took a lot of consultation, thought and preparation before this was achieved. So I think it's in the early 1950s, 51, 52, that the branch actually is formed. But prior to that, there have been meetings around our kitchen table, night after night, with a committee being formed. My father was the first president. My mother was the first teacher. And the financial considerations, because at that stage, everybody was on a very strict budget. So first of all, to find a hall that they could hire within their budget, and then to work out how to provide music, how to have it as a social group, how to publicise it. All of these things, if one reads the minutes, are discussed and thought about very deeply. So eventually my mother had made contact with the RSL Hall on Woodville Road. We lived in Woodville at that point, on Woodville Road, and discovered that that was within their possible budget for a venue. And then they worked out how they could have the music as records on a player and amplifier. And from there, they started off publicising first through the Scottish community, and then going out into the wider community to publicise the advent of the RSCDS. And the branch grew relatively quickly. There were some very good dancers who had joined into this group around my parents. And so Mum formed a demonstration team that she took out to various venues. I can think of us dancing at school fetes and at the Caledonian societies and various other things like this in an effort to publicise the branch and make it really viable. And then they continued to make it also a social part of life. So for the young Scots people coming out, it became more like the extension of a family, and particularly for our family, our special events happened at the dancing class. My parents' 25th wedding anniversary, my brother's 21st birthday, all these sorts of things. There would be a dancing evening, a social evening, and then a nice supper out in the side room of the hall. So it was designed to have this welcoming social part of life and keep Scotland close. As a child, I didn't realise probably how homesick my parents were, because I was only 7 when we came to Australia and 10, 11 when a lot of this was going on. So for me, that realisation has really only come as an older person, that they were homesick and so were the other people that joined in around them. And to a degree, the Caledonian Society didn't fulfil this need for them. They were looking for the comfort of the home things, like the country dancing. So it grew from there. And the other interesting thing that happened was the arrival of some of the ex-military personnel from here, particularly prisoners of war who had been in the camps in Germany. One in particular that I can remember is a lawyer, David Hogarth, who was eventually a QC here in Adelaide. And he was absolutely delighted when a new dance book appeared, and in it was a dance called The Reel of the 51st, because he had learnt the Reel of the 51st. It was devised in the prison camp that he'd been in, and he had learnt it, and he'd had to dance as a woman, because only the Scots danced the men's parts and the other ones had to dance as the women. So little stories like that are my memories. I was only allowed to dance in school holidays because I was still a school child, and my parents thought that I needed my sleep or do my homework. When they needed a bigger dancing team, my brother, my older brother, was part of the original dancing team. He was quite a good dancer. And then when they needed a bigger team, or two sets rather than just one for a demonstration, if it was an outdoor demonstration, I qualified in that with, because I possessed the white dress that was necessary. And I actually knew how to dance by then, so that was all part of it. Going back to the provision of music, the records, of course, were records with tracks. And so if you had to find the correct track on a record, you had to be pretty precise about where you dropped that needle. And that was a skill that some people found rather difficult. So Mum gradually trained a team of people who were able to get the needle into the right place so the dance could start with its correct bow and curtsy. She was quite particular, well, very particular about footwork. She had actually been taught and qualified by Miss Milligan, who was such a an enormous influence in the early establishment of the Scottish country dancing, belonging to the general movement of music at the time, where people who were part of the music scene were going out into the countryside and recording folk songs, folk dances, recording folk music. This was happening right throughout Scotland and England and in Norway, Finland, all through that area. They realised that after the Second World War, well, in fact, after the First World War, a lot of that heritage was being lost, that people were turning to the modern, the radio at that stage, and forgetting their old folk traditions. So Miss Milligan started up the RSCDS, well, what turned into the RSCDS, in order to capture the dancing tradition of the ordinary people. The Highland dancing has always managed to maintain its own tradition, but the Scottish country dancing was gradually disappearing. So Mum was part of that back in Scotland in the 1920s. And then it, as I say, was part of this homesickness that I think brought together the original group of dancers. Reading the minutes I found quite fascinating, because everything was costed to the last penny. It was fourpence per slice of cake, or fivepence per little pie, or when it came to a supper, and how many cups of tea could you get out of a certain teapot. And it was definitely everybody put in what little bit they could manage, but it was only a little bit. So this was the reason for trying to grow it bigger, because then more subscriptions and more chance to have it as a real social function.
What was the name of the club you started?
Well, I think they applied for branch membership, the RSCDS, right from the word go, because they had a teacher. That was the reason they had a qualified teacher.
So at that time, to be accredited was current?
Yes. Yes. I can remember that was a very joyful day when that news came through.
What's your maiden name?
Goldie, G-O-L-D-I-E. There's a very small clan down in Ayrshire of the Goldies. There's a fairly strong link, I think, to Ireland as well. Certainly my father was three-quarters Scotch and quarter Irish. So it isn't a big clan, but it has a tartan of its own. But he considers himself Scottish. Why I grinned at Les when we were talking about the records was he came to the dancing class with me before we were married, and Mum gave him the job of being the record player and then sacked him because he couldn't get it. He didn't get it as accurate as she expected it to be.
She was. No, she told me, Les, you're hopeless, let me do it.
Yeah, so that's at that stage, my father had had a major heart attack, and he used to do the records, but he often got upset about it, didn't he? He found it a strain, and so I think Mum was hoping that Les would be able to help, but it didn't work that way.
Did you mention your mother's full name? I didn't.
May. She was May, as well as May Goldie.
Your father?
Kieran. Spelled incorrectly. K-E-I. K-E-I-R-A-N instead of I-E. So,
interesting.
Yeah. Oh, the story behind that is that his uncle, who registered him, was drunk at the time. So these are the family stories that go on. They danced, I think, until we were a young family. There's quite a difference. My eldest brother's 9 years older than I am. The next one's 4 years older, and then me. Then we moved south in England. So I think they lost the contact there. And then, of course, the Second World War happened, and we were just outside London, and nobody was dancing at that stage. My father was working on the Spitfires in the big factory.
Doing what?
He was a foreman of the tool room. So he had 12-hour shift on, 12 hours off. It was an enormous... And in that stage, he had an hour each end of that 12 hours. So it was really a 14-hour day that he had to hand over, or had the tool room handed over to him. That was just so important that everything went smoothly.
And what part of Scotland did your parents come from?
They both grew up in the mining district south of Edinburgh. Mum was at Bonnyrigg and Dad was at Lasswade. So, and at that stage, there were very vibrant youth communities. I met a lot of the people that were my parents' friends when we went to Scotland in 1977 for a year. And the parents I knew, who were, of course, older people, were not the parents that were described to us, were they? My dad was a rugby player and very full-on as a person, where I knew him as a very quiet, very sedate person. So even establishing the branch must have been a big mental effort for them both, that they drew people in like that and got it going. And then, as I said, Dad had a major heart attack and resigned from the presidency. Mum kept going teaching for a long while, but she gradually handed over. She encouraged people like May Sinclair to gain their teaching certificates and have somebody to hand over to.
And your father, what was he trained as?
He trained as an engineer, but he grew up, he turned 18 as the First World War finished. And that, from there, you get the onset of the servicemen returning needing jobs, and the flu epidemic, and then the Depression. So he actually went out to Canada and was working as a boilermaker engineer on the icebreakers coming out of the St. Lawrence's and clearing the ice down that passage that was so important to Canada. Mum went out and joined him, and they got married out in Canada. And then they really got caught in the Depression and had to come back to Scotland where they could have family support. By then my eldest brother was born. And at that point then jobs were very, very scarce. They were working for a pittance. Mum taught again, which was very unusual. She was a trained phys ed teacher. Women were not encouraged to take the jobs at that stage, but that helped to help us as a family to survive. And then, as I say, we moved south in England, where Dad had major jobs in the war effort, or the pre-war effort first off, but or the early days of the war, and then very big job in towards the end. First to Southampton, and then we came up and we were living fairly near Heathrow, the big airport. In fact, Mum used to count the flights. It was actually called Heston Airport at that time. Count their flights going out, the fighters going out, and then count them back in and be aware that two, three hadn't come back, and perhaps one or two would limp in hours later with their engines coughing. We survived the bobbing there, and the flying bombs. We luckily were not hit, but I still have some memories of going out the back door to go to the air raid shelter and there being fire, not too close, but fire all around. So the war had an effect, even as a very small child. And I'm pretty sure it had an effect on my brothers. You would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would. I don't know very much about the effect with Kit. He was the younger of the brothers.
Mm.
But Ian, it certainly did impact on him.
Yes. I was 4 when the war finished, so I've only actually recognised effects in much later life. My family laughs at the fact that I have to keep a pantry full of food. And I now realise, particularly after we helped my brother clear my brother's house, that this was an effect of the rationing that was so severe. My mother described her ration of meat for 1 week as 2 ounces, or that's 50 grams of meat. That was her ration as a woman who was not in the workforce for 1 week. And I don't know how she managed to feed us all as a family. Everything was just so considered. And therefore, I know that I probably make a fuss about meals being on time and people coming to table when they're called, because I just know that the food is precious. So I really, as I say, can't give you too many descriptions of my feelings. I mean, a 3-4-year-old, I just have these small memories of how it felt. And I was very lucky in having a loving, supportive family who kept the family together. I mean, my father, as well as doing these long, long shifts, whenever he wasn't on a shift at night, he'd had to go out on fire watch, walk the streets and check the blackout, that because every window had to be blacked out. So, you know, the war effort was huge from everybody in order to have a little bit more food. They had an allotment and grew cabbages. I think cabbages is the main things I remember. But yeah, that added extra food to the table because that wasn't rationed. With the ration books, even the children got something like a tea ration, and we didn't drink the tea, so Mum had that to swap for somebody else's cheese ration that they were not using, or things like that. The whole community was involved in the support of the nation. It was quite an incredible effort, and a wonderful effort in that respect. I mean, you don't want to go through a world war, which is what makes some of the current situations just so difficult for the world leaders. If you've been through a world war, that's the last thing you want to see again.
Talk about your beginning of interest in dancing, country dancing.
Well, I got taken along in my school holidays. And it was easy to me. Wish it was now. It was just a family interest. As I say, the big social events of our family life were held at the dancing class. So, and I have other memories. I think, as I say, it was easy for me, of being sent out to the supper room with certain people who I suspect their footwork didn't come up to mum's standards. And I was sent out to practice and take these with me. So, I can definitely remember things like that going on. And when we had a gap of, 40 years that we didn't dance. When I came back to dancing, I found that I turned the wrong way frequently. And I think that was because I danced the man's role whenever there was a need for an extra person, because I could do it. And therefore, I had just got into this habit of dancing and turning the man's way instead of the woman's way. That's been quite a hard adjustment in some ways for me to get back to dancing as a woman.
I think it's one of the easy things about men is that they never play a woman's role.
Somebody had to at our class a little while ago, didn't they?
I'm not sure who you're talking about.
Can't think who it was, but we were short of one man, and to make up a set of five couples or six couples or something that we needed for that particular dance, one of the men had to dance as a woman. So, yeah. Right.
Imagine it takes quite a skill.
It does. You've actually got to focus very hard. We started back in about 2000, I think. I would have been in my 60s, once Les retired. As you heard, I've done so many other teaching things that there wasn't much time for dancing at that time, and we were away such a lot with Les's work. And he just saw an advertisement in the paper in Melbourne for the Box Hill Scottish Society and said, how about we go to Scottish country dancing again? Which we proceeded to do and had a lovely welcome from them. And great encouragement. That's the wonderful thing about Scottish country dancing teachers, is the encouragement that they give. Yes, we can upset a total set, we know that. But our teacher manages to be there and quietly go like that, point in the correct direction, or just say it, a movement behind us, and make it all work. So, the teachers make such a wonderful contribution to the vibrancy of the society here.
Did you mention which club you went to?
In Box Hill. Yeah, Box Hill Scottish Society.
Where's Box Hill?
Melbourne.
Oh, Melbourne.
Yeah.
Oh, tell me about Melbourne.
A different setup there. They actually didn't belong to the RSCDS. They were the Box Hill Scottish Society. Quite a number of the members belonged to the RSCDS and went to branch class, but that was separate from Box Hill. And it had been going for, I think, 60 years. We were part of either the 50th or the 60th anniversary of that society before we came back here. So it was vibrant. It was quite a bit bigger than we are here, although I haven't been to branch class lately, so I don't know how vibrant that is. When we came back here, we made contact with some of the groups, and we first of all went to the Wednesday morning over there at the Druids Hall, and then Wednesdays got a bit busy, so we now go down on a Friday night to the Woodville class at St Margaret's Church. Noriel Ataka is the teacher down there. And we had Jean Lumsden and Mary over at the Druids Hall, all wonderfully welcoming and happy to have some extra dancers.
Are you a member of the branch?
Yeah. Yes.
So, how long have you been a member, and what do you do as a member?
I don't do very much. I pay my subscription. How long have I been a member? Well, the 60th anniversary of the branch the ball was held, and I think I was a member before that. It's when we got back here to Adelaide. So I didn't join the branch initially, but I joined later on, feeling that my parents' hard work had gone into the establishment and that I should contribute to the maintenance of it being a vibrant society. So Les and I are both members. Mum was the official teacher, yeah. And learning was easy. As I said, it was very easy for me to do that. I'm fairly musical by nature, and therefore to fit my feet to the music wasn't a difficulty at all.
Elizabeth just looks so stunning and spectacular.
Stop it, you're
when I was
isn't?
Asked to change the record, I was in a daydream still.
Liz, why don't you come and join us? What's your history together?
Well, it was quite accidental. I decided one year to do geology as an extra subject. I had no background in geology. I was teaching at what was King's College at the time. And when I went to geology, I must admit that I noticed Elizabeth in the group, and as luck had it, we were matched together to do the practical. So it sort of went from there. King's College
in Adelaide. It's Pembroke now.
Oh.
Interestingly, when we went back to Scotland in 1977, I was working at the University of Edinburgh and discovered that my ancestors lived in Musselburgh. So I picked up on the Scottish ancestry there. In fact, my ancestor, Richard Berry, was a minister and also a sea captain, and he used to trade between Scotland and Quebec. And eventually he decided to bring his family out to Australia. And that was the time that he was commissioned to bring out a paddle steamer for work on the Murray River. This was called the Murray, and he wrote a book which I later obtained called An Old Tar's Yarn, and gives a fascinating account of his history and my ancestry. He started the Adelaide City Mission in Adelaide when he arrived here, and interestingly, we've just purchased his gravesite to look after it, because a lot of the old graves are in disrepair. I think I retired about 2001. I was head of a department of computer systems engineering at RMIT, and living in Melbourne, or near Melbourne, in Canterbury, I was aware that Elizabeth had a background of Scottish country dancing, and discovered that there was a branch at Box Hill. So suggested that we join, and that was my first experience of Scottish country dancing. Well, of course, I had no idea what a Strathspey was, and when it was announced that we would have a particular style of dance, I would muddle on, and the people there were very helpful. And eventually I became interested in the dance structure formation, and tried my best. I'm no great shakes now, but living in Adelaide, like to go to the classes, both locally with Jean and down at Woodville with Noriel. And the people are extremely friendly. It's good exercise, good fun, and hopefully helps my lapse of memory. Originally it was something to give back to Elizabeth. I remembered her as a young girl dancing, or younger girl, and when time freed up a little bit for me in first stage of retirement, this was a nice thing to do. What do I feel about it? I think Scottish country dancing is a wonderful social event, but more than that, the wide variety of dancers has intrigued me. In fact, one night I turned up at the dance with two or three new dancers that I had attempted. So I became interested in trying to compose dancers, and Noriel was very good and had the group dance the formations. Mind you, they're not the best, but they were a beginning.
Did you mention a date when you met in
1961? No, we were here in Adelaide, 1961.
You mentioned...
We went to Scotland in 1977 for a year with the whole family.
Right. You mentioned a time in Edinburgh.
That was 1977.
Okay, so that was a lot later.
Yes. It was when we came back to Australia in 1978, I picked up my piano studies again fairly seriously and had some wonderful mentors who encouraged me greatly and put together for me the fact that I was interested in music and in the piano and a teacher. And encouraged the teaching aspect of the piano, which then came together when we were in Thailand doing one of Les's sabbaticals, and somebody on the campus wanted a piano teacher. So I ended up teaching piano, and the campus school at that stage was without a swimming teacher, so I had taught swimming for many years before that, so I ended up teaching swimming to the campus children who came from, how many nations did we have? About 42 nations on the campus.
At least that number.
Yes. The Asian Institute of Technology, where we were, was a graduate university, so they all had to have graduated in their own home country before they came to do a postgrad diploma. And they had to have one term on campus on their own before they brought their families. Once the families were there, the campus school had all its lessons in English, so you had children from Tibet, from the Philippines, from Taiwan, from all those Asian nations. And Australia was a big contributor to this institute under the Colombo Plan. So these children would arrive mostly with no English at all and then have to do a complete school course under the Australian system at the campus school. So I'm saying this because I had children who had never indulged in anything in water come to me, who the depth of the swimming pool was fearsome, absolutely fearsome. But when they got into it and started to experiment, they just loved it. And I thoroughly enjoyed both my teaching roles while I was there. Different, very different, Asian children are very different to deal with because they have a much greater innate respect for the teacher and what the teacher says. So if I say stop that, they stop. And as I say, a lot of these experiences have been really great for me, and given me a very, very interesting life along with what Les has been doing. I had taught swimming when I was at Teachers College. I had done, because at that stage at Teachers College, we all had to do a two-week course in swimming. I think this was because so many of the teachers went out into country areas and they had to be a bit of everything. So I had done, because Mum was a phys ed teacher, I suppose I better go back to that. I had learnt to swim when I was quite small. When I got to do this swimming course at the Teachers College, I got sent to the deep end because I was going to do a bronze medallion, a Royal Lifesaving bronze medallion, which I then did, and the following year qualified as a Royal Lifesaving instructor. So when I needed pocket money, going through Teachers College, in the holiday Learn to Swim campaign, I applied and, of course, got a job teaching at Grange Beach, I think it was at that stage, and built up some pocket money that way. Then I withdrew from that once we were married and waited till my family was involved in the Learn to Swim campaign and did a certificate which they required at that stage. The Education Department required an AustSwim certificate, and I did that. And eventually we had the whole family involved in Learn to Swim campaign with my elder girls teaching, my youngest still in the program. And they had a program of activities down at Victor Harbour where we were, of sailing and also and windsurfing. So Les went into the course as a considerably older person and learnt windsurfing. So, you know, it was just a complete family activity that we enjoyed all together. When Les initially started that PhD, I think our eldest was probably about 7 and our youngest would have been a year old, and we have 4 children. So it was pretty busy, but as a family we had another family that was in a similar sort of set of circumstances, with their breadwinner studying as well. So my friend and I used to take the 8 children out to parks and all sorts of places like that, and give them a quiet house to work in. So they all grew up with, shh, Daddy's studying. Daddy's working. But they got there, and they've all turned out quite reasonable people.
Well, there are no better people than our children and their husbands.
We have 4 beautiful daughters, 4 wonderful sons-in-law, and 12 grandchildren. So you can consider that we think we're very, very blessed.